Welcome back to the Catch Pitch Show, everybody. This is your co-host, Mike Moran, and I'm joined this evening by our usual co-host, Neil Pinchard. Hi, Neil.
Hey, Mike from sunny Minnesota.
We're recording this on the evening of January 22nd, so I doubt there's a lot of sun right now in Minnesota. And we're also joined by third co-host, Glenn Trowbridge, a knife modder and repairman and restorer of great fame. Glenn, thanks for joining us this evening.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Oh, our pleasure. Our pleasure. I'm sure we've got 1,000 questions lined up for you. And I know that you and Neil have some history together, and that's one of the reasons you're here tonight. But can't wait to get into hearing about some of your guys' adventures and your work modifying knives, Glenn.
Looking forward to it.
It's going to be fun.
I wanted to mention, I was kind of shocked to hear that Jason Ritchie isn't going to make knives anymore. I had heard he got some contract to make a bunch of souvenir spoons for a wedding, some wedding somewhere, and they ordered, I don't know, 20 or 30, you know, kind of these.
I don't think he's making them. I think he's farming them out to offshore.
Oh, so he's not even going to make them.
Yeah, he's just putting his name on. He's probably lasering his name on the spoons.
Yeah, I thought it's kind of, you know, it just bummed me out that he's not going to make knives, but to switch over and make spoons. You know, my mom used to have this rack of souvenir spoons, you know, that had South Dakota and all the different states. And that's kind of what I'm guessing Jason's doing, is that maybe that's just a whole new niche for him. You know, there's probably a better profit margin. But anyway, if any of our listeners out there have more to add, I'd love to hear, you know, what's going on with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he's carving out his own niche, so to speak.
But, seems like an untapped market.
It is. I'm sure that's it.
It'll be the new thing for the EDC crowd out there on Instagram. They'll eat that stuff up, carrying spoons around in their pockets.
Yeah.
Then there'll be spoons with pry bars on the end, and there'll be spoons with little, you know, crown lifters. It'll go on and on and on.
Pocket clips.
Yeah, pocket clips, anodized pocket clips, titanium, mocha tie, you get whatever pocket clip. You're welcome, Jason, for helping you create another business.
Can of cold beans in one hand and a pocket clip spoon in the other. You know, there's just, it'd be like quick draw.
Yeah. Actually, speaking of our man in the field, Jason Ritchie, I do have an update from him in regards to truck talk. Now, I know on the last episode we said we'd probably cool it on truck talk for a while, but Jason has he has this truck for the railroad. It's called a high rail, and it's your typical truck. We've all seen them. They've got the ability to lower down wheels to ride the rails like a proper hobo. And his truck is in the shop, so he's got a loaner, and it is a Jeep Gladiator.
Ooh.
And he is not happy. So he's not impressed as a loyal Tacoma owner. He is not impressed with the Jeep Gladiator. So start sending all your hate mail to Jason Ritchie. You can find him on Instagram.
All you Jeep guys, yep.
Leave us out of it. Yeah.
That's right.
He's not a big fan, and he's also not a big, so I guess he's been running up and down the road in this Gladiator, and he keeps getting everybody waving at him, you know, the Jeep wave, the little two finger thing that Jeep owners do. So he's over the Jeep wave. He's mad about that too. So that's our update from our man in the field, I guess.
So Mike, I'm not a big tech guy. And I don't even know how to get to Instagram, but I know all of you popular young folk put your knives on different social media sites and they sell within seconds. So anyway, I got a notice from you showing a new knife that was available. And I thought, for once in my life, I'm going to look at this right now. And by the time I hit the look at button, it said, sorry, sold. And I thought, I'm always amazed at how fast that you guys sell knives. I mean, it's not like a day or two. It's not an hour or two. It's not a minute or two. It's within seconds these things sell. And it, as an old guy, it just always amazes me that things happen that quickly.
Yeah, they do happen quickly. We're pretty fortunate right now how that works. But always trying to stay one step ahead of our tech overlords and communicating with customers. But
yeah. So, Mike, what are you making right now?
I'm finishing up. Just I'm on my little straight jack kick again. I just like making that knife. It's super practical. I've been carrying around one in my pocket, and I switched things up a little bit and put MagnaCut in this particular one. I think we talked about it in the past, but I made a knife with MagnaCut last year, early last year, maybe January. I forget. But right as I was going to peen the knife, I kind of turned around and caught the knife on my workbench and dropped it. And it cut through my floor mat. It went blade tip down, cut through my floor mat, and stuck into the concrete floor.
Holy cow.
And this stupid idiot went, reached down, and as I was pulling it out, I kind of pulled it out at an angle and bent the tip on it. But I looked down in there, and it cut into the concrete.
Wow.
And that's when I knew that MagnaCut was pretty good stuff, but I kind of shied away from it throughout the past year just because it is a monster to hand finish, and I'm sure anybody that follows the whole MagnaCut discussion knows about that, but it's got vanadium in it and just super hard to finish. The sandpaper at higher grits just skates right off the steel. So I've shied away from it, and it's expensive and it's a little trickier to work with and so on and so forth. But anyway, I'm back into MagnaCut. I bought a whole bunch of it. So I just made my first one, official one, without dropping it into the floor. And I really like it. It is, I can tell, I haven't even sharpened it yet. I can tell, like, it is just great steel. It's definitely a super high-end steel. So I'm looking forward to making more knives in MagnaCut.
Glenn, have you worked with MagnaCut?
I haven't graduated to doing my own, stock removal and heat treat and things like that, as we have talked about in the past. I'm still kind of in the modding stage and playing around with other knives, but I'm close.
Good. Glenn, we got to talk about our road trip. That was so doggone fun. Before we get to what you do with your work, I just thought it'd be fun to tell our listeners that it was 2013, wasn't it, that we went?
2015, I think. Yeah.
15.
I believe it was 2015.
Okay. I even forget where we met. Did we meet at Dimitri's house?
No, Dimitri picked me up, and then we, in Nashua, and then we went down to Myron's house.
Okay.
And that's where you guys were.
Okay.
We all hopped in the Dimitri truckster and made our way out west to New York.
That's funny to hear somebody say out west to New York.
From Mass. But,
that's right. So we went to the Canal Street factory that was just fascinating for me to see because they had all the machinery and several of the employees that had worked at the Schrade-Walden company previously. And they gave us a great tour of production, watching them make the things. I guess one of the highlights was seeing and talking with Eric Elbers, who was working there at the time. And for me, it was fun just to watch him adjust a knife to take and tap and shim. And I don't know if he calls it or what you guys call it, tweaking, playing, but kind of fitting the knife together. And then obviously we saw the rest of the processes of the grinding and it was just neat. And it was cool to see all this old machinery that's been working for, I don't know what, 75 years. I mean, this stuff all came from a lot of this equipment came from the Schrade Cutlery factory, well before World War II. And here this stuff is just honking along, pounding, smoking, grinding. It was like watching an old robot just going at it.
Right. I mean, it looked like, to me anyways, that a lot of the machinery was purpose-driven made. I think there was one particular piece of machinery. It was a pin spinner And it looked like something somebody just put together. It had, you know, drill chucks on either side, and it looked like it was just something like, I need to do this, so I need a machine that I need to put together that will do these things. And of course, a lot of them, to your point, Neil, that had the Schrade manufacturer, you know, Schrade factory sticker stamps or plates, nameplates on the side. I actually took a ton of pictures when we were there, and I had actually posted them on Blade Forums in a thread of our adventure. And I think in
what's
the,
that thread called, Glenn? Do you remember?
It was I had to actually recreate it because in the photo bucket purge of 2000 whatever, I lost a lot of those pictures. I think it was something along the lines of Canal Street Cutlery Tour or something along those lines. It's
so people can search that up.
Yeah. I apologize for not having the exact name, but I like to go back and revisit it every now and then. As Neil said, Eric was quite the host. Obviously, he must have gotten Wally Gardner's blessing to do this. But for me, I was like a kid in a candy store, getting to look at all these workbenches with just, you know, tools and toolboxes and just knife parts everywhere, and just everywhere you looked, it was just like a treasure, you know, like a treasure chest, just getting to see all these processes. Plus, they had some of the older stuff, machines, the presses where they're stamping out blade blanks, and they have their gauges and just everything that they used from the Schrade, you know, days, and that it was clear that they were still using that technology, those processes to put out knives, at, you know, for Canal Street Cutlery as well.
Yeah, I'm always amazed at how a company like GEC can do so well and Canal Street didn't, because Canal Street, I thought, put out a really good product. They were popular. They had a good following. And I suppose it boils down mostly to management.
I thought I had heard something about one of the employees had passed away, and this person was a real, whether it was a woman or a man, I can't remember, was a real pivotal employee in the company, and it that kind of just sent things into a little bit of a spiral. And I mean, there might have been some other things going on, obviously, but they were still putting out good products. Eric had really, since he had gotten involved with the cutlering and things like that, had really kind of, in my opinion anyway, it's kind of really taken the product kind of to a different level as far as quality, a lot less product, you know, coming back for, you know, for warranty type issues. So, and you could tell that he just took a lot of pride in what he was putting out. And it seemed like maybe that was a little too late in the venture, but they put out a lot of nice knives during their time, for sure.
They did. So, Glenn, I'd like to jump over and ask you more about your foray into the knife world. When did you start? When did you start doing what you do currently?
So I've always kind of played around, you know, in the workshop with different things. I would buy, you know, blade blanks out of Atlanta Cutlery and Jantz, and, you know, solder some brass guards on, and, you know, do some, you know, Corby rivets or whatever, and, you know, make fixed blade, you know, knives that were already pre-ground. You know, I was doing that early on because it was easy. You didn't have to really know a lot of the processes. Certainly not, you know, what custom makers are doing by any stretch. And then I was getting involved, or through the forums, I was seeing guys like Dale Vincent, Caleb Reynolds, and some of the other guys. Some of the guys on AAPK, not as much on Blade Forums, because there really wasn't as much of the modding, tinkering type stuff going on, at least not that I was aware of. But on AAPK, there were sections in the forum for people to share the work they did, and there was, you know, quite a few really good modders and mechanics on that particular forum. So I kind of got the bug from that, and I was, you know, terrified of taking a knife apart. One of my first knives I did, and you can see it here, is a Remington fish knife. Obviously, the viewers can't see that, but I didn't even do anything with the pins. I kind of took the thing apart, slapped the covers on, and you know, hafted them down and called it good. So, and I was just terrified of actually disassembling a knife, that I couldn't get it back together. You know, and that was probably, it started around like maybe 2006. I started tinkering and playing around with knives, you know, actually doing some stuff with them, but really didn't get started like heavily into really doing that work until probably around 2010, when I really started, you know, diving into modding and taking knives apart, swapping out handles, replacing a blade here and there, and obviously, you know, learning the craft. You know, I mean, starting out with, you know, the Harbor Freight 1x30, you know, grinders, you know, belt sanders, which honestly, if you get them dialed in, they're not bad. You can actually do a fair amount of work with them. Obviously, they don't take the place of a nice, you know, 2x72 or anything, but you can get by. You can get by with hand tools if you need to. Obviously, power tools make the job go easier, but I always, you know, I graduated probably too quickly from the hand tool game to, you know, to the power tools, because, you know, time is precious and you got to get something done, you know, quicker. So maybe I skipped some steps because I didn't really go through the hard knocks of doing everything by hand. But, you know, but here I am, what, 2024, and still doing it, still learning, still making tons of mistakes, but, you know, slowly but surely kind of getting a better product out there for people, you know, that trust me with their family heirlooms or just knives that they've purchased that they want to, you know, get rid of ugly, you know, plastic covers and put something nice like stag or bone or whatnot, ironwood, you know, that type of thing. So, and yeah, so that's kind of, you know, the short version of everything, I guess.
How many knives do you handle a month?
It's very hit or miss because it's a hobby for me. You know, so family comes first, obviously. Work, you know, kind of comes next. And then if there's time left over, then I'm in the shop, you know. Everybody treats it differently. When I first started out, I'm like, oh, this is great. I just going to run down to the shop and I'm going to spend all this time down there. And then I'm like, yeah, maybe I should be spending a little more time with the family and, you know, and not so much. As a matter of fact, during the holidays this year, I don't think I saw my shop for about 2 months, just between holiday, you know, Thanksgiving and holiday and winter, you know, winter stuff and just everything, family and everything. So it's, you know, I always tell our, you know, potential customers, I have a backlog and I'll get to it when I can. And I apologize. And, you know, if you can wait and then hopefully you'll be rewarded with a nice product at a really good, you know, decent price.
Neil, I feel like this is kind of a hostage situation. Like I should be telling Glenn to blink twice if his wife's in the background. But
yeah, I think it's fair.
No, she's she understands. I mean, obviously, you know, it's not like I'm out at a bar or something. You know, I mean, yes, I'm wasting time, quote unquote, but I'm doing it down in my basement. I look at it as a form of therapy. You know, just, you know, if I've had a rough day, I can go down there and just, you know, play with my tools and, you know, work on a project, and, you know, and I'll work at the pace that I want to work at, and if I'm not feeling it, I'll just step away. So I don't, you know, ruin something or, you know, it's just, as you can probably, you know, attest to, Mike, that not every day goes well, you know, and sometimes you just got to step away and kind of do a reset.
Yeah. Or throw something. One of the two.
Yeah.
Or all of the above. Exactly.
Yeah. So, Glenn, I got about 40 questions, but one is, of all the different brands like Case, Boker, GEC, are there some brands that you prefer to work on, some that are easier, some that have better tolerances? And with that said, are there some that you go, oh, God, not that one again?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I already know how I feel about that. I enjoy working on older stuff, although, you know, if it's family heirlooms, I'm really, you know, kind of, you know, get a little bit of a pucker factor there when you're working with that stuff. You don't want to break anything that can't be replaced. But brand-wise, GEC is fine. I'll work with Great Eastern Cutlery all day. They're well-made. They're as close to like a production, you know, handmade type knife as you can get, I guess. So a lot of the parts can be interchangeable. Case, I'm not a fan of working on Case knives. I don't know what it is. I always seem to have a problem blending pins in the bolsters for some reason with those. I don't know what it is. It's whether it's just a certain type of, you know, blend of nickel silver that they're using, and I don't know. It's just that's so. Those are probably, yeah. So I'll work on Great Eastern Cutlery anytime. Those are fine, and any other brand also, Schrade, and you know, anything that's out there, K-Bar or any of those guys. But Case is probably the one that I like the least to work on, and it's requested about as much as any other brand to work on. So I do the best I can with it, knowing that it's at the end of the day, sometimes those bolster pins don't blend as well as you not like to like them to be. And sometimes they just don't hold well. I don't know. I find probably with the custom side of things, Mike, that you that stainless seems to hold better. I don't know. It's just, it seems like when I work with stainless, it's a lot more forgiving with blending. I don't know if you can comment on that at all.
Yeah, I think so. Then trying to match some like nickel, silver, or brass, which you don't know the percentages of alloys in it, etc., can probably be pretty challenging. I guess I'm at a loss. Why are people sending you $40 knives to work on? But
well, some people right? I know that's kind of a half a joke, but I've had worse than $40 knives sent to me, and it's, you know, like, it's not really my place to question what somebody's sending to me unless it's like just a total piece of junk. And then sometimes I'll just say, yeah, I can't do much with this, but I'll do the best I can with it. I've seen some that are like, you know, this is a Pakistan knife, but it's a family heirloom. What can you do with it? You know, and of course, you know, I'm a sucker for that type of thing. So I'll definitely do my best to work with that. And if the customer is willing to pay, you know, the prices that I want to charge for that, then I'll give it a go, you know. And it's not, you know, I guess it's not my place to say what people hold special or want to work on, but I get it. You know, a lot of times, I guess, getting back to that point, there's a lot of family heirlooms that, you know, mm-hmm. that have been passed down, and they're not always the best quality knives, but you know, they're special to them, you know?
Sure.
So that's all I need to know.
Glenn, in doing your modding work, I know that you add blades and subtract blades. What are a couple of the more interesting mods you've done that you thought, I wouldn't have thought of that, or I'll do it. Are you sure you want it done that way?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people will get like a harness jack type knife and don't want the punch, you know? Or, what's the fun one that I had? Somebody gave me, Urban Jack, I think. And then they had an 85 or an 86 pattern. These are both GEC models, by the way. And they wanted the cap lifter out of the 85 with the comb on the Urban Jack, but just those two things on there. And then so then I said, well, why don't I take the blade from the I forget what it was. I honestly can't remember now, but took the spear blade from that knife, and I actually transplanted it. I made it a single or something. I can't remember exactly what I did, but it was very interesting, and I did have to kind of play around because the width of the cap lifter blade was not the same as the spring that it was going into, so I did have to kind of take things apart and work with that. But it's always interesting to see what people. And then I think I did a sow belly, a case sow belly, where somebody wanted to take out, I think it was a spay blade, and put a cap lifter at that end, and I managed to do it. But yeah, there's most of the time they're fairly vanilla mods.
I support that, by the way. Definitely get rid of the stupid spay blade.
Oh, that's right. We have a spay blade thing here. Okay, that's yeah. So and I always say, hey, as long as I can do it, as long as the blade will fit, you know, in the well, or you know within the package that I'm trying to do, I'll give it a go. But most of the time I have to tell them, look, I have to see this knife. I have to hold it in my hand. I have to make some measurements before we determine that anything can really happen, you know.
Yeah. On the work that you do on these knives that come in, would you say there's a certain percentage which are like recovers that you do versus blade deletes or additions? What's the breakdown on that kind of
work? I would say probably about 70-30, so 70 recovers and 70% recovers and 30% blade deletes. Blade deletes are quicker on my time, especially if you're not doing a recover at the same time, because a lot of times you can retain the original pin material. You're just going to lose a little bit of it as you're dropping down from a two blade down to a one blade. You can probably reuse the same pins and everything, which are nice, which is a nice thing.
That's being thrifty.
Yeah. Well, I try to be thrifty with that, so that the pins that go back in are the same as they came out. So,
have you ever made a knife from all the parts you've taken off other knives? I'm saying it kind of tongue-in-cheek, but it sounds like you'll end up with handles, you'll end up with blades, you'll end up with maybe even liners. It's like, man, you could almost build a knife with the...
A little Franken knife?
Yeah.
I've built a few knives out of, say, one liner, a blade, and a spring, because that's all that I had left over from a delete. And I've built a few and given them away, on blade forums. One of my most famous ones was I did a, I can't remember the exact models, but there was a member on BF. His forum name was Big Biscuit. He was very well liked on the forums. He was very generous on the forums, very friendly to everybody. And he passed away due to some medical issues. But somebody had sent me a knife that he had modded a blade. I think it was a pruner blade down to kind of a sheep's foot blade. And so the same person sent me another pattern that he wanted that knife's blade put into the frame of this other blade. So I ended up with this modded blade from Big Biscuit and a frame for I think a pruner or something along those lines. So I took that blade in the spring, and I had some nice red stag, and I made this really nice, I thought it was really nice, single bladed sheep's foot, I guess you could say. And then I did a giveaway on BF for that. I think Jack Black won that, and it was one of my favorite builds because it kind of took something from somebody else that was special to them that they had modded and kind of melded it together into something even more, I felt, special that I could give back to the to the traditional knife community through giveaways. And
was Jack disappointed when he got the knife and realized it was wasn't a lamb's foot, but it was a sheep's foot?
He was tickled with it. Absolutely. But what else would he say, I guess, right? But I've done a fair amount of those giveaways, those types of giveaways on BF. I've done ones where I'll just say, you know, five winners, you guys can pick the mod, you can send me the knife of your choice, or I can make something for you. There's always a give and take in those giveaways. I want to get something back or give something back to the community. So I'll always say, your entry is, you know, tell me something about, you know, your dad or whatever, or tell me a knife story or something like that. Share a picture, do something like that. I'm trying to kind of promote the community, the, you know, the porch, as we call it, on Blade Forum. So it kind of pulls out the stories and the pictures and the remembrances from people of their family and things like that. So I have fun doing that. It's not just fun making the knives, but getting the stories and all the, you know, the remembrances that go along with it. So I get as much reward from that, maybe more than, you know, than the people are that are getting the knives that, you know, that I give away. So it's mutual, but it's very rewarding to me.
Nice.
That is great, Glenn, because it's things like that that really not only promote the hobby, but make people even more more enthusiastic, more energized, more feel like they're part of the hobby, not just somebody who's amassing knives. So that is a really cool thing. How about handles? Do you have any favorite and least favorite handle materials?
I love working with Stag. It's very durable. It's very workable. It's doesn't crack easily, at least not to for me. And I love what I love about it is you don't really know how it's gonna finally look until you kind of almost have it all hafted down and buffed out and, you know, polished. And so it's always exciting for me. And when I work with Stag with customers, I'll show them pictures of the sets I have or the rough pieces that I have, and they're always dark, obviously, if they're dyed and whatnot, and they don't know how it's going to look either, and sometimes I'm like, well, this piece may work, it may not work. Once I get it kind of, you know, ground down to rough shape, it may not fit on the liner anymore, and I may have to go with something different. So, but that's half the fun with that. So that's one of my favorite materials.
You said you're working in your basement, right?
Yes.
Wow. What's your wife think about the smell of Stag in the house?
It's not bad. I mean, I don't think it's bad. I mean, probably like ram's horn or something like that. It probably is stinkier than like Stag to me, you know. But she doesn't complain. At least she hasn't. Maybe she's, you know, writing up divorce papers unbeknownst to me. I don't know. But So Stag. And then I like working with bone as well. Probably my least favorite material is anything bone that's really light in color. It's tough to... Yeah. Polish without, you know, loading up the pores with compound and things like that. So it's very, and I'm not a fan of like the CA, you know, glue finish. I don't know if you've ever seen those where they put the coating of CA on there to kind of seal it in, but it's to me it looks kind of not fake, but it just kind of takes away from the overall look of things. I understand why it's done, but I like to work kind of natural. So I don't mind micartas. Micartas are fine. I don't do much with like G10 and some of these others. Do some Kieranite and some other acrylics. I work with just about everything, I guess.
I have to admit a secret here. Neil doesn't know, but I love Kieranite because I think it makes for a great handle. Now, I've never used it for a pocket knife, but I have made kitchen knives with it. I have a kitchen knife I made 10 years ago, and that stuff has not moved. And that knife is used every day. My wife, my kids, they leave it in the sink all the time. I mean, it is pretty bulletproof for certain types of knives.
What's the material?
Kieranite. It's kind of an acrylic type of material, yeah. I guess. I like it because they can do so many different things with colors and mm-hmm. shades, and you can just blend all these different colors. You can have glitter. You can have just everything. You can have kind of
and
a pearl.
It buffs up real
yeah,
shiny.
Yeah, it buffs too. Up really. Yeah. It's pretty durable, and it finishes mm-hmm. very well, you know. So some people, obviously, you know, it's not really a prime choice for a custom knife, but any type of rehandle, or to your point, maybe a kitchen knife or a utility knife. Yeah, absolutely.
That's really good. Yeah.
Do many customers send you their own handle materials?
Yes, they do. What I usually do is they'll sometimes ask me, hey, I'm looking for this. I'm looking for some, burl or ash burl or something along these lines, or maybe some really type of gnarly stag or something in specific. And if I don't have it on hand, I'll just say, please find what you like, send it to me, and I'll work with it. I'm trying to remember. Oh, I had an interesting one. I had a Lee Schechter, don't you? Neil. He was a long blade. He used to be on AAPK, and his father, I think, was a musician or something, and he had a utility knife, just like a scout type pattern, and he had some, I think it was Brazilian rosewood or something along those lines, but it was part of a I guess a xylophone or whatever that that his father had all this wood for. So when I recovered his knife, he wanted me to use some of that. And they're actually, one of the pieces I used had like an F sharp or something, that the note on there that was, was burnt in for the, that you would see on the instrument. So I made sure that that was visible in the knife scale, the cover. So yeah, so that was kind of a neat thing that he had this wood that his father had, and he sent it to me, and I utilized it in that recover.
Very cool. I know I'm not telling you guys anything that's new, but I went to a wood store recently. I think it was called Woodcraft, and not only do they sell, you know, tools and planes and woodworking stuff, they had a huge assortment of just chunks of wood, and I have never seen so many varieties of interesting woods, colors, grains, textures, patterns. And I don't know if either one of you two guys have gone into a specific wood store to look for stuff, but I couldn't believe the variety.
I mean, speaking for me, I buy a lot of my stuff online. You got to be careful and look for stuff that you know has been had a chance to, you know, set and stabilize or has been stabilized. If you buy, you know, I think somebody sent me some mesquite one time, but it wasn't very, it was freshly cut. And I think there was some shrinkage on the scales after the fact. And so, yeah, you gotta obviously, I don't know what, like wood stores like that, or like a lumber store or whatnot, you can find some nice woods in there, but I guess you got to make sure that stuff is stable before you work with it. I don't know what your history has been with that, Mike.
Yeah, I think the same thing, Neil, and Glenn. Like those woods are neat in the wood stores, but they're not, let's face it, the cutlers in the 1700s, 1800s, they figured all this stuff out. They knew every tree that was out there for the most part. They went after the ones that made good knife handles because they were hard, they were dense, they were oily, they were stable. And there's only a few of those woods that meet all those criteria. So, you know, the cocobolos and that type of thing, that's what we stick with. They don't offer those in those wood stores. You can't buy the types of woods that have traditionally been used in cutlery at a Woodcraft. You know, you can buy like whatever, Purple Heart and all that nonsense, walnuts and stuff like that. But that stuff doesn't make for good knife handles. It's either too soft or not oily or it moves or whatever. So I'm actually getting away from woods just because I'm living in the desert now. I'm too nervous to put them on after sitting in my shop and then ship them to a humid place. So I'm actually getting away from some of the natural material for the moment anyway.
Well, Mike, you must have a good source for some ironwood.
Yeah, I have ironwood in my backyard. Yeah. Yeah, saguaro, like, it's like a woody, pulpy thing inside. It's pretty hard, but I've seen, we have, there's a species of cactus called choya, and there's multiple different types, but we have tons of choya where I live, and I've seen a lot of people stabilize it and fill it in with resins, etc., because it's got pores, huge holes in it, and that makes for interesting handles, but yeah, nothing I'm super interested in at the moment.
Can you take pretty much any material and impregnate with some kind of an epoxy? I'm thinking like cork. You know, cork can have kind of a neat look to it, but obviously it's super soft. Can you take a cork and somehow engulf that or impregnate that with some kind of a glue solution and make it hard enough to use for a handle?
Yeah, that's what a lot of folks do, right? They will take softer woods, especially more porous woods, like burls of different species, and pull in resins, etc., and harden that and try and stabilize that wood the best it can. It's still going to move over time, but it cuts down on the movement and makes it suitable for knife handles. Most likely it'll shrink over time, but yeah, you can definitely do that. There's all kinds of people, you know, you've seen the ridiculousness of like stabilized or casted pine cones and corn cobs and that kind of stuff in the past.
Correct me if I'm wrong. They're using cactus juice as a stabilizer in a lot of these products. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's a company, I think the company's called Cactus Juice, right? I don't know. I actually don't remember anymore, but there's a product out there that a lot of folks use called Cactus Juice, and you can soak a wood or a product in it and put it under a vacuum, and when you release that vacuum, it'll pull that into the pores of the substance and kind of stabilize and harden it. And other people do similar things with resins and glues and that type of thing. KMG here in Arizona is pretty popular for doing that for people. You can actually send in wood and have it stabilized. So that's a good option. That's probably an option I would recommend if people are curious, instead of trying to do it yourself. So
yeah, I've played around with dyeing products a little bit here and there. I do have a tank and a vacuum chamber to do that. I honestly haven't busted it out yet, but I was playing around with some old school methods of dyeing stag, and I had okay results with that. But I want to start kind of digging into the vacuum chamber and seeing if I can pull in some dyes into stag better with that process. Yeah. As opposed to just, you know, like almost like a potassium permanganate, you know. Yeah, or simmering your product in a dye bath of some type, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think we talked about it on a previous podcast, but there is a thread on Blade Forums about using gasoline, and I think that probably gives the best results. I've played around with the vacuum chamber as well, Glenn, on bone and stag. It never really seemed to make a difference on those, at least those two substances.
I mean, honestly, right now, you know, there's, you know, Culpepper does a really good job with, although it can be hit or miss, but they're one of the ones out there. There's not too many out there that actually work, you know, do the dyeing and stuff. So you're actually doing limited. It yourself, or you're relying on what's out there. So, you know, I guess that drives your vision, or, you know, how you want to do things. If you can get something, or if you're, you know, too cheap to pay what they want to charge for it, then I guess you get your own stuff and start experimenting in the shed or garage, you know. So yeah, I've done the gasoline and gasoline and ATF automatic transmission fluid or brake fluid or something. So I had actually okay success with that method a little bit, not full full die, you know, full dying of product, but, you know, decent
results. Decent, yeah, you're never going to get deep penetration. It's only going to be surface level or into the surface a little bit. Definitely not RIT dye. You know, there's tons of threads out there on using RIT. That stuff's garbage. I mean, all it does is dye the surface, so it just wears off. But I'm sure it works good on certain synthetic materials, but I've never had much luck on natural materials other than surface level depth, and I would never let a knife go out like that. So just it'll wear over time. Yeah, GEC. When you do a GEC tour, that's one thing you'll never get to see in their factory is, I won't go into details on what it looks like, but their dyeing process. I'd say GEC's dyeing processes are probably one of the better ones out there.
Yeah, I wasn't quite sure because a lot of their product looks like some of the other stuff out there. So you can attest that they're doing their own dyeing and such, Mike?
Well, I've seen a room. How's okay. that? Yeah.
We've heard rumors.
Yeah, I don't know if they buy, if they do much of their own or...
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Secret rooms with double doors. I don't know how much they do and how much they buy from other vendors.
Right. Yeah, usually I can tell. I know Culpepper stuff pretty well, so I can usually tell, oh, that's an American Standard jig, or that's a Richmond jig, or, you know, you can see their jig pattern, so unless somebody's copying it, but even like the dye colors, you can usually tell, oh, that's that amber Richmond that I love, you know, whatnot, so... Yeah. And that's fine. I mean, great. Sometimes you can't source you can't make what you need necessarily. So you got to source it where you can get it, you know?
Yeah, for sure. A lot of that knowledge is kind of lost as far as jigging the bone goes or large slabs.
Glenn, do you have one or two nightmare projects over your time that you can think back and go, oh God, everything that could have gone wrong went wrong with this from beginning to end? You must have one or two that you thought, oh.
I do, and I wrote them down because, so one of them was a Moki lockback, and I think it had like a black Zytel handle, and so the customer wanted, so it had no liners. I don't think it had liners. I had to make the liners, so they wanted like green canvas micarta or something. I can't remember what it was. So lockbacks are fun to work with, not to begin with. So I ended up working on this thing two or three times because I put my best effort forth, and the customer didn't like it. Rightfully so, I guess. I mean, this was kind of like in the early years when I was a little less confident in my work, you know. And, you know, and they'd like, I don't like it. It doesn't sit right or it doesn't lock up right. So I said, send it back, you know. So I think somewhere I have a bag of old liners and parts and stuff, how many times I remade this knife and finally got it. Maybe the customer just took pity on me and just said, yeah, it's awesome. We're good, you know, but, that was probably the worst. And then I had it's very rare, but I do occasionally break a blade or whatnot. And I think I was trying to crink something. It was a Baron Sons Stockman, and I was trying to crink it, one of the blades, because it wasn't fitting quite right. And tink, you know, the blade snaps in half. So that went from a Stockman down to a single real quick, and the customer was very understanding. But those were the two that I remember, you know, very vividly that were just failures. And I guess it's, and you, Mike, you can probably, you know, relate to this. You know, you have those knives and they keep you humble, right? They keep you in the game and trying to always, you know, kind of hone your craft and get, you know, get them as good as you can. And then you just think back and like, oh boy, I remember that knife and it was just an utter failure. And,
yeah. Yeah. Hard to look back on a lot of those, but, and I never took it well. And, you know, I always tried to figure out how to improve. And now when something like that happens, you know, I just, I usually throw it, but I look at it as an opportunity to, you know, change my process or improve something or think outside the box, that type of thing. So it doesn't happen as often these days, but it still happens occasionally.
Yeah, for me, it can be a little frustrating because if I have somebody's knife, I have to kind of return it in a state that's at least as good as it was given to me how I would want to return it to a customer. And it's not like I can take another hunk of metal off the shelf and remake it. I that's what I have to work with. So they're not all prom queens, I gotta say. You know, usually, you know, with
you put
hat
your best effort forward.
Yeah, with hat, you know, hat in hand, I go to the customer and say, this, I did the best I could with this. At the end of the day, this is, you know, it. And sometimes I've said, don't pay me. I don't want any payment. I did the best I could with it. I apologize. I don't want any, you know, you to pay me for this. It's not, I don't feel comfortable taking your money for something I didn't really do, you know, as good of a job as I feel I could have done on it.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Have you ever returned a knife, Glenn, for one reason or another? You said, I won't do what you want, or I won't work on this particular knife for one reason or another.
Yeah, that's happened a couple times. I think somebody recently sent me some parts. I think it was a Boker. I can't remember. It was Boker Stockman. No, it was an A.G. Russell Stockman. And the parts they sent me, the liners were, I mean, the frame and the liners were from a different knife or something. I played around with that knife for quite a long time trying to figure out if things just needed to be ground down a little more, because like the blades weren't really like fully ground down. And I played around with this thing trying to get it. And just at the end of the day, I'm like, this knife blade is way too huge for this frame. It's just, there's not the right parts. But I don't give up easily. As far as that goes, to my point before, that if I'm having a rough time with something, I'll just step away and come back to it, you know, when I'm in a better frame of mind and trying and go at it. Again, I've, anything that I'm like super intimidated by, like old school, like automatic knives, I just, for something, there's a lot of moving parts in there and they just bother me. And then you're making new covers for them. There's a lot of pins and holes and things and levers and everything else. And it's very intimidating. So some projects sit on the bench longer than they need to, just because I get intimidated and frustrated by them. And I just walk away and I go and work on something else until I'm, you know, feeling more confident to go back, you know, back to it. But it's very rare, but I have returned a few for, you know, for this reason or that.
Glenn, I have a question. You know, you're working on so many different types of knives and brands of knives and stainless and carbon steel and lockbacks and automatics and so on and so forth. There's so much to figure out and to know. Do you have, there's only a few of you knife repairmen and modders out there. Do you have others that you are friends with or rely on to help you as far as knowledge or bad ideas around? Or do you just, you're a guy that likes to just kind of tinker with it and figure it out yourself?
You know, I don't, I'm at the point where I guess I mean, there's always something to learn, right? So there's always somebody that's doing it better than you or come up with a cool idea. Occasionally I'll reach out to those guys and just say, you know, here's what I'm trying to do. You know, have you had any, you know, problems with this or, you know, luck with this? But a lot of times it's just, you know, if somebody's sharing their work, I can see something cool that they did, or they'll say, here's how I solved this problem. And I'll be like, oh, wow, why didn't I think of that? It's interesting, you know, to see what others are doing, the ideas they come up with, the inventiveness, the creativeness. You know, I don't have this part, so I'm going to use this instead. I'm like, wow, that's really cool. And, you know, Sometimes you work with what you got in your shop. You know, if you have an old rusty nail that but it as a pin, it'll work great, and you use that instead. And or I'll make a shield out of a cartridge, a spent cartridge or something like that. Cool. So there's always like guys out there that are way more creative than me. That have a good artistic, eye, and will have these cool ideas, and I'm always really impressed by what they can do, or how they can kind of think outside the box. I'm kind of a generic, run of the mill modder. I don't get too far out of my lane, but I will say that working with so many different knife brands, old, new, this and that, you kind of have to have a lot of everything on hand. You're not just working with a 3/32 pin. You're got to have the whole shooting match. You got to have it in 410. You got to have it in 416, the nickel silver, the brass, all the different thong tubing stuff. You just everything. You need to have kind of a full shop, and sometimes lack stuff with that like that. But that's, I guess I'm jealous of makers, custom makers, that this is the pattern I make. These are always the pins I use, so you kind of...
That's right. That's how it should be.
You're kind of locked in, and you're working with one set of ideas in your head. And so you don't have to deviate or have a lot of different stuff. But I guess that's part of the challenge for me is like, oh, I need this pin here. I think I have some of it here. And
I need 83,000ths. Right. Thick nickel silver pin.
What? Yeah. Honestly, the GEC uses a pin size that I have not been able to find in normal.
Yeah, it's 80 some thou.
It's like 0.082 or something like that. And I can't find the exact pin out there for it. So a lot of times I'll buy something bigger and shave it down or use something just a slightly bit smaller. But it's a challenge, it's a challenge.
Do you ever just re-drill those holes?
It depends. The only time I'll do something like that is if, maybe the, things aren't like fitting well, or if I have to kind of, tweak the spring a little bit, and I need a little something bigger because it's kind of reamed out. So yes, I will occasionally drill out those holes a little bit. I try and stick with what's there, but occasionally you have to do that to kind of get the action better, than what you're given.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just depends on the scenario. I know like GEC is pretty famous for not leaving much meat above that middle pin on the spring. So you can't always drill those. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're coming up on an hour, and this might be a good place to stop it for the evening for us here anyway. Glenn, I know I probably speak for Neil, but it's great to have you on and hear a little bit about your background and your work on modifying knives and restoring knives as well. Where can folks find you if they do want to talk to you about?
Well, I'm on both the Blade Forums and AAPK. My forum name is Glenn Bad. So if you search on those forums, you should be able to find me. I don't have Instagram.
And AAPK is
all about pocket knives.
Yeah. Which is another knife forum. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So, I am on Facebook, but only as my personal self, obviously. I do frequent, a lot of those Facebook knife pages, but not as my forum name, Glenn Bad. Okay. So those are the two most, popular places to find me, I guess. So.
Good deal. All right. So you guys out there with your $10, case Sodbusters, hit Glenn up. He'll be glad to charge you money and work on that thing. Shoot. All right. Well, Glenn, thanks again for coming on. And thanks all for tuning in and listening. And hope you enjoyed this episode. And we'll catch you on the next one.